Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
Welcome to Think on KERA. I'm Alan Melson. Chris Boyd is on vacation. Our guest this hour is Matt Dellinger, who has written for The New Yorker, The Atlantic, The Wall Street Journal Magazine, and other publications. His new book is entitled Interstate 69, The Unfinished History of the Last Great American Highway, and it explains the rocky history of the highway and how it could impact cities along its planned route, which includes a large stretch of Texas running all the way down to Laredo. Matt, welcome to Think.
Hi, Alan. Thanks.
So can you give our listeners a brief overview of the Interstate 69 project?
Sure. I'm not sure there is such a thing.
Yeah.
But that's why I wrote a book. But, yeah, basically, this was not a many people think it was sort of a government plan, like the U.S., some Blue Ribbon Commission got together and said, you know, we need a NAFTA highway. The story I tell in my book is it's very different. In fact, this began as a plan for a highway in southern Indiana. And the people there were frustrated after many decades of trying to build a stretch from Indianapolis to Evansville. And so they sort of set out down the country looking for other cities that might be interested, because they figured if the road were longer and went through more states, it would be more politically viable. So it was kind of a grassroots effort, surprisingly. And that story has been forgotten because it was 20 years ago. But, you know, and plus, right around the time that the people kind of put forth the idea of Interstate 69 was a time when the federal government said, okay, we're done with the interstate system. So each state has had to pursue I-69 in its own way, and it's kind of encouraged each state to think about I-69 as a state project instead of a national corridor.
And you talk about that at the beginning of the book, about how the original Eisenhower interstate system that most everybody knows is pretty much done. The economic reality has changed. And so what happened with that trust fund they had socked away to build future interstates?
Well, the trust fund, you know, it was created in 1956 as a way of paying for the interstates. And basically it would a mechanism to take all the gas tax money and certain fees that have to do with your tires and your trucks and the title on your car and things, and collect those in Washington and then redistribute them to the states. And there was a little problem that came up in the early 90s, which was that the federal government was on the hook to complete the interstate system, but they kept changing the engineering rules and the safety guidelines, so they were never going to be finished. So they just kind of said, okay, the interstate construction program, per se, is over. And this trust fund money now will go back to the states, but you'll be able to spend it on other things if you see fit. The problem with the trust fund, as I think you mentioned, is that the gas tax has been the same since about that year, since 1991 or two. And meanwhile, inflation has gone up, the cost of gas has gone up, and fuel efficiency has gone up. So a lot less money is going into that mechanism of the gas tax, and we're, you know, nationwide really facing a funding crisis. So I-69 was a big idea to start with, but it ran into an even bigger problem, which is that we're just not equipped as a nation to build giant infrastructure projects anymore. And I think you're seeing that everywhere.
Definitely. Now, in Indiana, I know they've already built the northernmost portion of the interstate, but they've run into trouble actually getting it beyond the state's borders. Why is that?
Well, the part from Indianapolis north through Fort Wayne and into Michigan, Flint and Lansing, that was part of the original interstate system, which was drawn up in the 40s, even though it was not passed until the 50s. So that was always on the books. The southern part ran into some very fierce opposition. The notion of a new terrain highway causing landowners to get upset will not sound unfamiliar to your Texas listeners. But, you know, in the case of Indiana, the opposition really started right away in the early 90s. And there was a group in Bloomington, Indiana, where Indiana University is, that, you know, that the town is generally has an environmentalist, fairly liberal political bent. And they felt that this plan was a waste of money and an economic or an environmental disaster. Why would you? We've seen what the interstates have done, they said, and there's plenty of interstates with beat up towns and high unemployment along them. why would you say you're going to bring jobs by basically tearing down forests and severing farms? So they've been leading an opposition there since for 20 years and filing federal lawsuits. And Indiana had to start all over on their environmental study in the late 90s because of it. But they're building it now. There's construction happening in Indiana.
And in the book, you talk about some of the more visible protests that took place around Bloomington, some of the violence that took place, and the more sort of anarchist-type groups that brought up their opposition. Have they sort of moved to the side now that the highway's actually under construction?
That has fizzled out. And it wasn't violent. No one was assaulted or harmed. It was more vandalism, I would say. They would kind of throw rocks through the window of a DOT office, and they were up in the trees, you know, tree sitting. It was quite a scene there for a while, and this actually coincided with some of the more fierce protest in Texas over the Trans-Texas Corridor. They've kind of fizzled out. I mean, the FBI was on their case. They made some arrests. Some people chained themselves to a truck in the driveway of an asphalt company and were arrested, and then there was a civil lawsuit saying they cost the company business. So they sort of they did a very methodical job of shutting those people down by slapping them with a big lawsuit and pressing charges, which were ultimately dropped or pled down. So things have very much quieted down, but who knows if it's forever.
We're speaking with Matt Dellinger about his new book, Interstate 69, The Unfinished History of the Last Great American Highway. You can join our conversation now by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send an email to think@kera.org. Now, Matt, you write about some of the changes in the route of the highway based on politicking by city and state and federal leaders. How did that affect the highway's path through Texas?
Well, the highway's path through Texas started out there was a state plan. The people in Houston and elsewhere wanted to upgrade 59 to interstate standards. So that would have been, you know, from up near Texarkana, Lufkin, down through Houston, and on through Victoria and Laredo. That desire to upgrade 59 actually existed before the idea of Interstate 69. So when the people from Indiana I was talking about came through Houston, they got some people behind it up in Lufkin, but Houston wasn't that interested. They just wanted to upgrade U.S. 59 and be done with it. They didn't see any reason to involve themselves in this big national plan. But the folks in the valley, someone down there heard about I-69 because they were sitting on an airplane and overheard something. And they kind of went back and asked the state, you know, are you really planning to build this interstate? And they said, you know, we don't want to be left out again. We're the largest metropolitan area, this is the valley, without an interstate highway access in the country. And if you're going to build this I-69, it's got to come to the valley. And they kind of made a lot of noise, but they ultimately settled it. They met with the folks from the valley, met with folks from Laredo near Corpus Christi one day and kind of had a little summit, and the Laredo guys said, you know, if you want to lobby for it, we're not going to stand in your way. And in the late 90s, it was written into legislation that I-69 would actually split into three pieces near Victoria, and one leg would go to Laredo along 59, another leg would go down 281, and another leg would go down 77. It remains to be seen whether all three of those will actually be built to interstate standards. But, you know, you're actually well on your way down in the valley, down near along 77 and 281. They've been upgrading those roads for years, not without making much noise about it, just kind of replacing a stoplight with a bridge, you know, or getting rid of some driveway access so that I think within a couple of years you'll just be able to put up those I-69 signs.
Yeah, I know you gave a couple examples in the book of these big interchanges that or bridges that sort of rise up out of nowhere along the highway down there. Have those just been paid for out of normal state Department of Transportation monies? Or
yeah, they sure have. It's been, I mean, pieces of this road up and down through the seven states. Some of it's been earmarked. Some of it's been state fund. In Indiana, they paid for a lot of the construction with revenue from selling, leasing off the toll road. So it's really been a hodgepodge of funding solutions. I would have to say, though, that Texas, despite all of the brouhaha over the Trans-Texas Corridor, Texas has done a great job of just kind of picking small projects that will make a difference once you add them all up. And yes, it does. It creates a few surreal experiences, because when you drive down 77 and you're kind of going through ranches and farms and you don't see many other cars, and then suddenly there's a multi-million dollar overpass bridge over what's essentially a dirt road. But that's what you have to do to make a U.S. highway into an interstate.
Right. Now, the route that 69 would follow through Texas, kind of along the old Highway 59 corridor when it first comes into the state, that puts it less than 200 miles from the Dallas-Fort Worth area.
Mm-hmm.
And I know we have a lot of traffic that comes through here along Interstate 35. How do you think the completion of Interstate 69 would affect traffic here in the North Texas region?
Well, I don't know how many I've not seen the studies about specifically the Dallas region and how many of those trucks are just passing through, or whether Dallas is their destination or point of origin. But you'd have to think that, you know, if you look at the highway map, to get from Houston north on the interstate system, you pretty much have to come up 45. And to get from Mexico up north through Texas, you've pretty much got to use I-35. And Dallas is where those two roads come together. So there's a very good case to be made that it will alleviate I-35 traffic by a great degree if you build I-69. I think that's in the early days when Houston finally decided to get behind the national plan. It was in part because there was an I-35 corridor that was getting together and saying, you know, we've become the de facto NAFTA Main Street, and we need more federal money to help maintain our roads because they're getting a lot of wear and tear. And Houston wanted to sort of get their piece of that traffic. So they're certainly expecting some of those trucks to come through Houston instead of Dallas, and I would imagine that would be the case.
You talk in the book about how there was some politicking that went on regarding the city of Shreveport just across the border in Louisiana, and there one individual in particular who is a businessman in Shreveport who helped sort of navigate the early planning for Interstate 69. Did that affect where the highway came into Texas? Is there a chance it would have come in further west?
Well, it definitely affected it. And to go back to the story I alluded to earlier, where there's a man from Indiana named David Graham who wanted to, you know, make this idea of a national I-69 happen, and he wasn't getting much help from the politicians in Indiana. So on his way home from Shreveport, on his way home from Mexico, he stopped off in Houston and Shreveport and Memphis and met with the Chambers of Commerce there. And he did indeed meet with a man named John Carruthers in Shreveport, who happened to be friends with Senator Bennett Johnston, and showed him the map that they drew by hand of where I-69 might go. And Bennett Johnston took that to Washington and wrote specifically into a piece of legislation in 1992 that Interstate 69 would go through Shreveport. So that was written into law thanks to that businessman you mentioned and his senator friend.
We're speaking with author Matt Dellinger about his new book, Interstate 69, The Unfinished History of the Last Great American Highway. When we come back after this break, we'll be talking more about the Trans-Texas Corridor and how that affected the highway. You can join our conversation right now by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending an email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, languages, history, and communication start weekly in January. Details at smu.edu/think.
Welcome back to Think. I'm Alan Melson, in for Chris Boyd. Our guest today is Matt Dellinger, who's written a new book about a planned north-south interstate cutting through the United States, including Texas. The book's called Interstate 69, The Unfinished History of the Last Great American Highway. So, Matt, you talked briefly about the Trans-Texas Corridor plan before the last break. This was a plan put forth by Governor Rick Perry in the early 2000s that would basically cut this huge swath of infrastructure through the middle of Texas for cars and trucks and rail and fiber optic cables and all kinds of stuff. How did Interstate 69 get tangled up in those plans?
Well, you know, when Rick Perry presented this plan, it was in a report called Corridors of the Americas, Crossroads of the Americas. That was in 2002. He was running for re-election. And a lot of people thought that it was just sort of, you know, big talk. He was trying to get reelected. And then in 2003, as your listeners will remember, the House, the Texas legislature, sort of quietly passed a bill that allowed all of the privatization and all of the tolling that were envisioned as part of that plan before most people had even heard of it. Interstate 69 had been on the books for about 10 years, but because of the problem with the trust fund that we were talking about before the break, and the fact that gas tax dollars were dwindling and there just wasn't money to build something as big as Interstate 69, the Alliance for I-69 Texas, which is the group that has always been gathered together in order to promote the building of I-69, they were the first group to endorse the Trans-Texas Corridor Plan. And essentially it was because they were being told by, I think, the governor and the Texas Transportation Commission and the TxDOT agency that this was the way it was going to get done. And if it wasn't, if you didn't go down this route of privatization, nothing was going to get built. And that was really their attitude at the time. So the I-69 group took them at their word and endorsed the plan. And I think that, you know, I was interviewing them at the time and interviewed them years later after all of the protest and ultimately the repeal of the Trans-Texas Corridor. And they kind of wish it had never happened, along with a lot of people, including some in TxDOT, I think, or that it was handled differently. And so, you know, but for a number of years there, TTC 69 and I-69 were supposed to be the second leg of this great vision, this Trans-Texas Corridor, the first being I-35 around Dallas, of course. And, you know, what the effect it had politically and locally, of course, is that along with the rest of the state, the people along the I-69 corridor were outraged by this. I mean, you had a plan that started out being, well, we're going to take the existing road and we're going to upgrade it to an interstate, which was okay with the landowners and the local governments. And you replace it with a plan where, well, who knows where this is going to go, and here's a drawing of something a quarter mile wide, and you're going to upset a lot of ranchers and a lot of local, you know, business owners who are saying, well, if you take all the traffic out of town, what's going to happen to me?
And in the book, you talk about how that the voice against the plan kind of found its focus in this couple named David and Linda Stahl, who live down in Central Texas, and they built this grassroots campaign on the internet that ultimately led to the defeat of the Trans-Texas Corridor, or at least in part led to that defeat. What do you think their effort and that type of grassroots effort have meant for the future of Interstate 69 overall in the state?
Well, it's true that, I mean, the Stahls are just remarkable people, and there are not many activists like them. They had kind of a perfect combination of know-how, and they're savvy both technologically and politically. David had been a city manager and worked in various other levels of local government, and you know, Linda was a great communicator, and both of them were tireless, and they really knew how to use the internet. I mean, they organized the Corridor Watch, which was their organization, to such a degree where they could be sitting up in the galley of the State House when they were contemplating a transportation bill. And if one legislator was holding up the process, what they wanted to happen, they could, you know, from their laptop, send an email to all of that person's constituents who were their members and have them flood the fax lines and phone lines. It was a real operation, and it put them ultimately, a few legislative sessions later, in the same position you would expect a kind of powerful lobbyist to be. As a result of all of the, kind of rolling back of some of these powers, I-69 has essentially gone back to being what it was in the 90s, which is an upgrade of 59, 77, 281, some combination of those. They now have some local, I think this is true of I-35 too, but definitely of I-69, they've gathered together some local advisory committees and a corridor advisory committee. So they're really making it a local decision-making process. They're involving business owners and kind of regular people in deciding what is going to be done. I think, I think one of the main problems, and a lot of people in the Texas Department of Transportation will acknowledge this, one of the main problems with the corridor plan was the way it was rolled out and the attitude surrounding it. TxDOT was extremely forceful about, this is how it's going to be done. Every project you want to build, you've got to think about from a toll perspective. And they've reformed a bit, and they're looking at involving the public from day one to a greater degree.
We're speaking with Matt Dellinger, the author of the new book, Interstate 69, The Unfinished History of the Last Great American Highway. We're going to go to the phones now. We have a call from Harold in Grand Prairie. Harold, welcome to Think.
Hey, guys, I'd like to remind our listeners, we have a 35, and I want the author to comment, we have a 35-year-old little girl, Deidre Delacie, that runs TxDOT, appointed by Rick Perry, because her mom and dad, quite frankly, own Rick Perry. It's the goal, let's let the author talk about this, the goal of these things are to turn these roads over to toll roads. Goldman Sachs buys the bonds. These roads, whether it's North Texas or Interstate 69, these are the Wall Street toll road authorities. It's the goal of Rick Perry and the Republicans to convert these roads over to toll roads. And before Rick Williamson died, that old burr-headed joker, it's by God, it's toll roads or no roads, and Republicans are still, God help us now, with the legislature being in control by these jokers, because this will be known, I-69, as the Goldman Sachs Highway of Greed.
Harold, thank you for your question. What's your comment on that, Matt? Do you think the toll road thing is a possibility for Interstate 69?
I think what's possible is a limited amount of tolling around I-69. So, what the state has promised, anyway, is that there won't be any tolls placed on lanes that are not currently tolled. They will be able to put tolls on any new lanes if they create truck lanes or if they create additional right-of-way. And then there's sort of ancillary projects a little off to the side, say that the road that connects the Corpus Christi port to I-69, they might be able to toll that and use some of that revenue to build some of the non-tolled sections. But if I can kind of widen the view here a little bit.
Sure.
I think the caller's point about tolling and privatization is one that is not going away. Even if Texas has kind of backed off a little bit from their philosophy, this kind of thinking is actually gaining momentum nationally. And it's ultimately because of the gas tax that I was talking about earlier. I mean, the way that we pay for our roads currently is when we fill up at the pump, we pay Uncle Sam a tax for every gallon of gas. That amount has not gone up. And Texas is a growing state, and it's building more roads to keep up with its population explosion. Now, you can argue that they should be building other things, or that they're building more roads than they need to, or wider roads than they need to. But even just maintaining the system we have is costing almost all of the money that we're collecting with taxes. So what the choices that we face are, we stop building things, which I don't think is what a lot of people want, or we raise the gas tax. And I'm not talking a couple cents. I mean, I think ultimately what they say we'd have to do in order to keep up with the demand of the bridges that are past their lifespan or the roads that are crumbling, we'd have to raise the gas tax something like a quarter, which would be essentially doubling it. And it's you know, especially in Texas, it's you know, you could get in big trouble for suggesting that you raise the gas tax 25 cents. It's something that's going to hit everybody's pocketbook, and it's to double any tax is a political suicide, or so people think. So that's the kind of math problem that leads people like Governor Perry, like the governor of Indiana, to say, well, look, we've got a private sector that wants a safe investment. And bonds, we already sell the banks in New York bonds. You know, they make a couple percent profit by loaning us money to build this stuff today. That's been going on forever. So why would it be that different if we got a better deal on those bonds because we're going to toll and there's going to be some revenue stream? You know, this is a big topic of conversation. I bet your listeners feel very strongly about this, but it essentially comes from this this impossible situation we're in, where you're not allowed to collect more money in any way, and yet you have to spend more money to keep up with what people want.
Have you found in your research that the states that built roads, you know, initially with the plan to be toll roads many years ago, like the New Jersey Turnpike or the Pennsylvania Turnpike, have those roads continued to pay for themselves? I mean, are they profitable, or do they at least break even?
They are. Most of them are profitable, or many of them are profitable. And, you know, that's why private investors have been looking to lease them, through some combination of they are profitable or they could be profitable. In the case of the Indiana toll road across the northern part of the state, when I interviewed the governor, he said, you know, we looked at what it cost us to collect each toll and what we were getting from each toll, and they were losing money. So he said, why don't we just put a cigar box out and let people do the honor system? We'd actually come out better. An international bank sees this and they say, well, we know from our experience that people would pay double. A governor can't raise the tolls because he'd get voted out of office. But we can if we take over control of this road, because all you could do to us is not drive on it. So, you know, we're to again, take it out to a bigger position, we're more comfortable with a corporation raising prices than we are with our elected officials raising prices. So in some cases, privatizing a road means allowing the operator to charge what probably should be charged in order for it to pay for itself. You know, and that's essentially what a lot of these privatizations are about. It's about a governor essentially outsourcing taxation, saying, look, you, the voters won't allow me in the legislature to raise these tolls ourselves, so we'll take a big upfront billions of dollars payment and invest it, and meanwhile, in 20 years, they'll raise the tolls and you won't be able to do anything about it.
We've heard a lot in the news the last month or two about the Deficit Reduction Committee that was put together by President Obama, and they put out their report with a series of recommendations to save money. Do they address the idea of these interstates at all, or of privatization of roads?
They actually recommend raising the gas tax. And this is a bipartisan commission of people who don't need to get reelected, and they say, look, we're not investing enough. The gas tax is too low, and it's been too low for a long time, and we need to raise it. I don't believe they specifically addressed the idea of privatization, but it is a growing bipartisan idea. I interviewed the governor of Pennsylvania, the outgoing governor, Rendell, and he believes, as certain people in Texas said over the years, that states should be able to put tolls on their interstates. And this is something that is forbidden now, unless you, you know, there's a few very special circumstances where you can do it, if you're adding capacity or if the tolls are going directly to the upkeep of that stretch of road. But, you know, a lot of people believe that tolling is a more sensible way to pay than the gas tax, because you're actually paying for the miles you drive.
And do you think that the midterm elections we just had and the turnover coming up in January in Congress are going to have any impact on kind of that mindset among politicians, both at the state and national level?
I do, and I think it will. I think it will lead to greater emphasis on privatization. In general, the Republicans, the conservatives who've taken over the House of Representatives, did so with the promise to lower government spending. That doesn't comport well with the idea of raising the gas tax and having the federal government become more involved in what gets built. I think, you know, as with other sectors of the economy, whether it be healthcare or retirement pensions or anything else, I think the in general, you know, there's, like I say, this is a more bipartisan issue than many, and there's a lot of crossover. But I think in general, the Republicans are more likely to look for a way for the private sector to become involved than the Democrats were. The head of the House Transportation Committee, James Oberstar, who not only lost his chairmanship with the majority change, but he lost his race. He lost his seat. He was very against privatization, and he thought the answer was to raise the gas tax or at least index it to inflation so that it was the equivalent of what it was in 91. He's gone now, and the Florida representative, Micah, is the chairman, and he's in favor of things like the infrastructure bank, and he's said nice things about privatization.
Which seems to go along with the sort of general anti-tax sentiment that has been
exactly.
Had a groundswell in recent months.
And it, you know, a lot of your listeners would correctly point out, well, look, if I pay a toll, that's not that different than paying a tax. And, you know, that's true. That's absolutely true. But it just depends on whether you prefer to pay a company that's making a little profit or pay a government entity that might be wasting a little bit.
Our guest today is Matt Dellinger. He's an author of a new book called Interstate 69, The Unfinished History of the Last Great American Highway. When we come back from this break, we will talk more about some of the towns and people along the Interstate 69 proposed route and how the highway might affect them. And we'll also take some more of your calls. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send an email to think@kera.org. We'll be right back after this break.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, languages, history, and communication start weekly in January. Details at smu.edu/think.
Welcome back to Think. I'm Alan Melson, in for Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with author Matt Dellinger about his new book, Interstate 69, The Unfinished History of the Last Great American Highway. And Matt, we got an email in from Dallas in Dallas who said, "We don't know what's going to happen to oil prices over the next several decades, so we need to protect ourselves from volatility. Just as any financial guru will tell you that you need to diversify your retirement plan, we also need to diversify our transportation infrastructure. It's time to look beyond highways." What are your thoughts on that?
Well, as as a New York City resident who does not own a car, I would agree. But you know, I there are a few people who would say we have to completely stop building highways, and I don't quite agree with that. I think there are, you know, always stretches to improve. In general, it's a very, very, very good point, and it's not a matter of kind of urban versus rural as much as you might think, and it's not a matter of kind of liberal versus conservative, you know, the people who want to give money away to mass transit and the people who want to keep it for roads. I think that it's becoming more obvious to more people that this is a quality of life issue, that, you know, whether it's because of oil volatility or just simply the fact that the way we've built our communities means that we're in our cars way too much time every day. I think that there's mass transit that comes in all shapes and sizes, and that if it's planned correctly, especially if it's planned correctly, it can be an extreme benefit to the economy and the quality of life in places. I just actually, there was a news item I think maybe out of Dallas, where the pitcher Cliff Lee left to go to Philadelphia, and one of the reasons his wife cited, was that they liked being able to get around on public transportation. This was in the Star Telegram.
And they're actually from Arkansas and live in kind of a rural area, so that's interesting.
Exactly. But, you know, here it is. We're looking at a growing population, an aging population. The baby boomers are all going to enter retirement. And older people are one of the segments of the population that are most interested in public transportation and that are most amenable to sort of living in smaller-sized houses or even apartments. I was in Kansas City not long ago and looking at some of these old warehouses that are being converted to lofts. And I said, oh, I assume it's mostly college graduates and people in their 20s moving in. And I was told, no, that you know, a lot of the people buying these downtown units are older people. Their kids have grown up and moved away, and they want to be able to walk to dinner. And something as simple as that is for way too many people just impossible. It's not about getting rid of cars. It's not about outlawing the automobile. But it's about being able to get around to your daily needs in some other way, whether it be walking, biking, or taking mass transit. So I would agree with your listener, and I think sometime in the last few decades, all of our state highway departments became state transportation departments, and some of them live up to that name change more than others.
We'd like to go back to the phones now to Jeff in Frisco. Jeff, welcome to Think.
Hi. I've got a comment, and I would be interested in hearing Mr. Dellinger's response. Texas has the largest number of petroleum refineries in any one state in the world. Any one state in the United States, and the output of the petroleum, refined petroleum products, is far vastly exceeds any other state.
Mm-hmm.
Texas is the only state, however, that does not impose a tax on refined petroleum products. And the percentage of refined petroleum products that are produced in this state but that are shipped to states outside of Texas is a huge percentage. It's vastly more than 50%. So if Texas were to levy a tax on each barrel of refined petroleum products, all the Yankees and everybody else would be paying for maybe as much as for every $1 Texas paid in direct taxes. We'd be getting $2 from all the Yankees and people in California and every place else. Has Mr. Dellinger ever looked at that angle in financing public roads in Texas? And you could use the money for anything. You could buy natural gas buses or pay for health care improvements or other social services.
All right. Thank you, Jeff. Matt, what are your comments on that?
Well, that is something that's been looked at, as a matter of fact, not by me, but by, governors and congressmen. There's a congressman out of Oregon who was number two on the Transportation Committee when the Democrats ran the House, named Peter DeFazio. He wanted to add a tax on oil speculation, so people just buying and selling oil futures would have to pay a small tax. And the governor of Pennsylvania, who I mentioned earlier, who's a big proponent of transportation spending, and he created with the Republican Governor Schwarzenegger and the Mayor Mike Bloomberg, who's an independent, a coalition called the Build America's Future. And one of his ideas was in Pennsylvania was exactly that, to raise money on the petroleum companies. And it's, obviously in a way it's sort of the corporate version of raising the gas tax, right? So you don't have to charge the person at the pump. You charge the company a few steps up the supply chain. It's still ultimately oil paying for roads, which keeps a little bit of the spirit of the gas tax. So it's, I think, that's got to be one of the things you consider.
We're speaking with Matt Dellinger, who's written a new book about the planned Interstate 69, which would run from the U.S.-Canadian border all the way down to Laredo and the border with Mexico. We're not going to go back to the phones. We're going to go to Ann in Fort Worth. Ann, welcome to Think.
My family owns land in East Texas, timber and pasture land, and I attended a few meetings over there of concerned persons. One of the great concerns was that the contract for building the road and operating it, which meant receiving the tolls, determining the tolls, determining who would have businesses along the route, was given to a Spanish company. And then also another great concern there was the large amount of land which was being taken up to build this road, and the landowners had not been brought along in the planning of this. I believe that I'm right in saying that it would take approximately 100 acres of land for every 1 mile of the proposed road at that time.
And this is the Trans-Texas Corridor plan that you're referring to?
Yes, it is.
Right. Yes, that was those were indeed the main two of the main points of concern, and people were very angry about both. I think especially about the amount of land that was to be taken. You know, the two points I would make about that. One is I think, first of all, the state has walked back again from the idea of the Trans-Texas Corridor. The current plans call for minimal additional land to be taken, at least outside of the corridor that already exists, the 59. You know, they might widen the 59 corridor to add express lanes, but they're no longer really looking at a completely new terrain route. And as far as, the Spanish ownership is a very interesting angle to this whole thing, obviously. And that did make a lot of people uneasy, the fact that one of the main companies bidding on these projects in Texas, Cintra, was Spanish. Now, Cintra is the company that partnered with an Australian bank, Macquarie, to lease the Chicago Skyway tollway and the Indiana Toll Road. So, and they've bought into a few other toll roads around the country. Defenders of this kind of international banking involvement would point out that when you build a road using bonds, oftentimes those bonds are bought by the same international companies, and that America in general is going way into debt by selling its debt to China. So even if we build roads with quote-unquote federal dollars, those federal dollars are probably ultimately coming from China in the short term, and they're probably making a percentage on it. So I think Americans have to get more comfortable with the idea of international investment in whatever shape and form it takes, or pay a lot more in taxes. And those are really the two choices. Now, obviously, there's a big difference between a Spanish company actually being the operator of a toll road and setting the price and buying the bonds. So, you know, the level to which foreign money might be involved. And it won't just be Spanish. It'll be, Asian money and Middle Eastern money even is looking to kind of buy into the American infrastructure system. One way that has been proposed that would allow international bankers and investors to invest without giving them control would be something like the National Infrastructure Bank, which would just be a kind of a central place for, you know, the bank would kind of choose a project that had some toll potential, and then investors, whether they be American or otherwise, would be able to buy, essentially debt on that project. So I guess my point is that this is something that takes many forms, and some of them we have accepted, and some of them we have not.
One thing I found interesting in reading the book is that some of the places that, sort of are on the receiving end of this highway, like, say, the Valley or Houston to a lesser degree, they seem more to support the idea of the highway because a lot of times it's going to be bringing business and goods and whatever to their cities. But I'm curious more about the small towns along the way, and you go into detail about some of the towns in Mississippi and in like Haynesville, Louisiana, for example, or in Texas, that are small towns, most have experienced declining population. Do you think that having a highway like this run right through their town or just past their town will have any kind of major impact on the town?
Well, there's no simple answer to that, frankly. I mean, people on both sides of the highway issue want it to be simpler than it is. The truth is that, you know, a town and its economy and its surroundings are always in a bit of a balance. And when you build a major infrastructure project, a bridge or a highway or a rail line, you change that. And the place has to kind of rise to the occasion and adapt. They did a study in southern Indiana, one of the universities down there, looking at what happened when a road like this was built in communities about the size of the ones in southern Indiana. And the news was not all good. It basically said, you know, this town called Oakland City is about within an hour from a bigger city of Evansville. And their projection was basically that Oakland City would be able to become a bedroom community, but they'd have to improve their schools and do a lot of other work that was going to cost money they didn't have. Other towns, you know, the highway maybe came within 5 miles of them, but not 2 miles of them. So depending on how far away the exit was, the highway could actually be bad news because it could mean that instead of driving on that two-lane highway through downtown, now you're just speeding by and you just see a little green sign that says, you know, Petersburg that way. So it can be a rebirth or it can be the death of a small town depending on exactly how close an exit is and what the town does to kind of create an identity for itself and respond. What the business owners, if you've got money to invest and you can kind of make yourself a destination, then it can be awesome news. But if you're hurting as it is and your downtown shops are teetering on the brink, then putting all the traffic way out in the countryside could be bad.
And you also have the people who moved out to these small towns and to the areas outside those towns specifically to get away from sprawl.
Oh, of course. Sure. I mean, but that's sort of the American mindset, right? We all want to live on the outskirts, or a lot of people want to live just far enough outside of a big city so they can commute to work, but far enough out where they can see the stars, and they want that UPS delivery in the morning, not in the afternoon. And I think a lot of us want it both ways. But it's true that in the book, I found a lot of towns where people, they're not interested in the kind of interstate economy that we all think of as America as being built on. They want something a little quieter and smaller.
Our guest today has been Matt Dellinger, speaking about his new book, Interstate 69, The Unfinished History of the Last Great American Highway. You can find it at bookstores and online now. Matt, thank you so much for your time today.
My pleasure. Thanks, Alan.
I'm Alan Melson in for Chris Boyd. Have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.